Today on Against the Grain, as movements highlight the perils of global warming and the inaction of governments in the face of it, what types of mechanisms could and should be considered to slow down the ravages of climate change? I'm Sasha Lilly. Geographer Holly Jean Buck argues that, as fraught as it is, the left needs to recognize the need for the removal of carbon from the atmosphere and to shape the ways that it's implemented. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. We know and have now known for decades that human activity has been putting dangerous amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, heating the planet at an alarming rate. And scientists have been ringing the warning bell with ever greater alarm about the urgent need right now to cut carbon emissions, most of which has fallen on deaf ears, at least as far as politicians are concerned. What would it take at this point to keep the world from heating to even more perilous levels, especially given the inaction of those in power? Most models that project the reining in of global warming calculate in something called carbon removal, which involves taking carbon out of the atmosphere through more natural means like reforestation or industrial means like carbon capture and storage. In her essay, The Need for Carbon Removal, co-published by Jacobin and Science for the People, geographer and sociologist Holly Jean Buck argues that while carbon removal has all sorts of pitfalls, it's going to be necessary to help stop climate catastrophe. And she posits that the left needs to get involved in shaping the politics and economics of climate removal, or it may be taken over by the fossil fuel industry for their own purposes. She's research fellow at UCLA's Institute of the Environment and Sustainability. In the fall, Versa will publish a book, After Geoengineering. So Holly, let's start with a broad question about the state of climate change today. One hopes that this information is already widely disseminated to the general public, but it still seems worth asking. How dire is the problem of climate at this point, looking forward?
Well, as most of the listeners will know, it's pretty dire. Right now, current emissions are at about 40 gigatons of carbon dioxide per year. So a gigaton is a billion tons. So that's 40 billion tons every year that's been emitted. And even if we bring down the rates of carbon dioxide immediately, which I hope that we do, there's still an issue of everything that's been emitted being up there.
Would it be fair to say that the scale of whatever kind of intervention that would be needed to slow the worst effects of global warming would have to be massive at this point?
So the efforts are tremendous, and there's been a lot of talk about, reaching net zero emissions by 2050, for example. So that's a huge project to scale up renewable energy to bring down emissions from agriculture and the land sector. And that's all one enormous effort where people are thinking about how to do that in the conversation with the Green New Deal and so forth. And then there's the matter of the carbon that's already been emitted, and that some experts think that we should embark on a large infrastructure project to remove some of that from the atmosphere.
Well, tell us about what carbon removal is. It's often called negative emissions. What kind of process is it? What need would it fulfill? And how technically feasible is it? I know there are different kinds.
Yeah, so carbon removal is kind of an umbrella term that's talking about techniques for removing carbon from the atmosphere. And some of this has been under discussion for decades. On the geological side of carbon removal, we've had carbon capture and storage projects, just a handful of them over the past few decades. And on the biological side, storing carbon in forests and in soils, a lot of discussion of that has been going on too under programs to store carbon in forests, reduce emissions from deforestation and that kind of thing. So while all of this has been kind of known about, it's received renewed attention in the past couple years because some of the integrated assessment modeling studies that have been done were indicating that to reach these goals set out in the Paris Climate Agreement, the 1.5 or 2 degree targets, large amounts of carbon would have to be removed from the atmosphere, which might not have been the case if we'd started cutting emissions, say, 20 or 30 years ago, but because emissions have continued pretty much full steam, now there's a burden that needs to be removed.
And so, in fact, some of the estimates, like the estimate of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, a lot of these estimates about getting global warming under control actually have built into them the assumption that carbon removal is part of this. So this is actually being calculated in the calculations that are being made. The assumption is that carbon removal will take place.
That's correct. And it's important to note that pretty much every scenario involves some type of large amount of carbon removal. Now, some models have imagined that to be done through bioenergy with carbon capture and storage. In response to that, modelers have produced some scenarios that rely on more on afforestation. But in either case, the scale of the removals is pretty large. So at minimum, usually around 300 gigatons or 300 billion tons. It's hard to wrap your head around when you hear these big numbers. But the land use implications of that, for example. So if you were to remove 300 gigatons by converting, say, abandoned farmland into forest land, that sounds like a really fantastic project, and it probably would be in a lot of context, but it would take about 500 million hectares. So for context, the area of the United States is about 983 million hectares. So we're talking about, you know, subcontinent scales of land conversion, which have a whole lot of nuance on the social side once you start thinking about where this land is and who might be affected by or participate in those transitions. It's a massive project, no matter which of these approaches you would take.
So in other words, what might sound like a very green solution could involve throwing all sorts of people off their land.
Yeah, and you know, civil society groups and social scientists and human geographers and all kinds of people have been actually studying that for a while now, with case studies from kind of initial forest carbon and biofuel projects.
Tell us more about biofuel projects and how they play into one type of carbon removal.
So in the theory behind bioenergy with CCS, you might hear it abbreviated as BECCS sometimes, is that if you grow biomass and then you combust it at a power plant and you separate out the carbon and you store it underground, that would actually produce negative emissions, i.e. more emissions would be removed from the system than were emitted. And so the thing with biofuels is that a lot of the projections in the models assume that you would be using advanced or so-called second or third or fourth generation biofuel feedstocks. So crops that wouldn't really compete with food or that could be grown on marginal land. And in reality, it's been challenging to scale up those advanced biofuel feedstocks because plants are designed to generally be woody and stand up. And so they have something in them called lignin that's challenging to break down. There's a few ways to do it, but right now it's pretty expensive to break down woody materials, which is why a lot of the biofuels used today are the so-called first-generation biofuels, like ethanol, for example, grown from corn. And we know that that does compete with food crops because that's been shown over the past decade. We had kind of a biofuel boom and then somewhat of a bust, you know, from 2007, 2008, 2010. And communities are still struggling with the fallout of all these biofuel projects being announced and then collapsing.
So you're saying that we actually have seen the displacement of land for food production by land being used for biofuel production?
Yeah, I think we saw that 10 years ago, and there's a lot of scholars and activists who documented some amount of that. And so that then when those same people see bioenergy with CCS, they're rightfully thinking, are we going to just see more of that same cycle all over again? And then, you know, modelers or technologists might say no, because we're assuming these advanced biofuels. But there's kind of a gap about thinking about, okay, how might we actually get the so-called advanced biofuels into production? And I think people are starting to think about this and really look at also the supply chain and the life cycle analysis of biofuels too.
I should say that I'm speaking with writer-geographer Holly Jean Buck. We're discussing carbon removal and global warming. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So for those reasons that you just mentioned, the way that the planting of biofuels has had pretty serious social consequences, for those reasons and many more, you argue that people who are on the left and or environmentalists are actually very skeptical about carbon removal. And yet you're also arguing that it is highly unlikely that policies will be put in place that will slow global warming enough for carbon removal to be anything but necessary. And so if it is necessary, which you're suggesting it ultimately is going to be, that people who care about social justice need to be involved in discussing and thinking about and shaping how carbon removal actually takes place. So let's talk about those concerns, the concerns that people on the left have about carbon removal. You've mentioned one of them. What are the other reasons that people might be wary of carbon removal?
Well, I think the main concern, at least that I have, is that right now the market for carbon that's captured is to go for enhanced oil recovery. So basically, if there's an oil field that's depleted, it's often possible to get more oil production out of these wells by injecting carbon into them. And so this is something that's been going on in the U.S. for, you know, a couple of decades. There's already a pipeline network of a few thousand miles of pipelines for carbon dioxide, mostly from actually natural deposits in Colorado and New Mexico that get piped to places like West Texas for enhanced oil recovery. And so I think that there's some conversation about what place that has in a kind of geological carbon capture and storage infrastructure. And my concern is that this kind of language of negative emissions or lower carbon oil or negative emissions oil production, which you start to see bubbling up a little bit, becomes the dominant way of thinking about carbon removal. And maybe it's obvious why that could be a bad thing, but just to spell it out, I think there's room for companies that have basically denied the existence of climate change to now pivot to becoming negative emissions oil producers and continue to kind of profit without accountability. I also think that there's a danger that that kind of low carbon oil could actually cause more oil production, and then emissions don't actually get curbed through it because the consumption increases. So those are kind of the concerns I'm most focused on, but I mean, there are others. More broadly, does the idea of carbon removal reduce energy for mitigation? I think that's kind of an open question. I don't think it necessarily has to be the case, but people are rightfully concerned about it.
So the concern is that, in a sense, it would throw a lifeline to the fossil fuel industry, which has a history of using this technology for other purposes. And so the concern is that then, instead of being made to go extinct, the fossil fuel industry would keep producing and then saying, well, we are offsetting this by removing the carbon that we're creating. Is that right?
Yeah, essentially, just like what you said. The thing I find challenging about this is that a lot of oil, about three quarters, is produced by national oil companies. So when we think about the decline of fossil fuels and how to manage that, it's not always as simple as, you know, we'd like to see Exxon go bankrupt, because in a lot of countries, the production of oil is so tied up with the economy and with civil life that it's a more complex discussion. But I do worry that talking about carbon removal decenters that transition away from fossil fuels.
Well, tell us more about that dynamic. In the United States, we're used to thinking about private entities being the oil producers. But obviously, if you look around the world, Russia would be one example, but there are many. As you say, state fossil fuel industries are actually the predominant mode. So what implications does that have to trying to put an end to these industries? I guess one could say, but if they are in the public sector, wouldn't it be easier for the state to be able to do something about shutting them down versus private entity? But I think you're making an argument about the degree to which states become highly dependent on these national companies.
Yeah. So I think that, for example, in a state like Norway, you might be able to imagine that happening. And I mean, hopefully will. There's some indication about that. But in some of these other states, the governance just isn't good. There's a lot of corruption. There's so much dependency. There's not really obvious options for economic lifelines beyond fossil fuels. And that's a really complex situation. But maybe carbon removal in places like the United States, which has, you know, a responsibility from historical emissions and the technology and the geological storage capacity to do it, can help play a balancing role in that somehow.
Well, and of course, it's not just states, as you point out, but also individuals who might be very unhappy about global warming may find themselves entangled in these fossil fuel interests, because if you're lucky enough to have a pension in this country, there are certainly various pensions that are totally tied up in fossil fuel interests. So how does that play out socially?
Well, I think we've seen some of that from the divestment movement, which I've been encouraged by the success thus far of that. And I think that in a way, it's almost, there's a good aspect to that, because it makes it more of a discussion for civil society what we do with these fossil fuel companies. It's not just seen as this business decision for business people to figure out, but it's really kind of, in some ways, our problem, even though we wouldn't like it to be, and even though many of us haven't benefited at all from these developments and are actually harmed by them. It's somehow we're all entangled with figuring it out. And if that can be kind of front and center and for us to discuss, I think we'll get better outcomes.
Well, we'll talk more about some of the politics around carbon removal, but just staying with these larger questions about, you know, the future of the fossil fuel industry and what that means socially. Because what you're basically arguing is that all of these things are public concerns, and we, or the public, are much more tied up in so much of this than even some of us realize. I mean, we are, whether we like it or not, actively subsidizing the fossil fuel industry. And yet, whatever happens, the fate of these companies, which obviously affects us all as global warming affects us all, can affect us in a different way, which is, if looking down the road, we can imagine that a number of these companies may ultimately go bankrupt. What kind of implication does that have for the public?
Yeah, I'm really concerned that we end up somehow bailing out these companies, or that, you know, we pin some hope on them paying for adaptation, for example, and then they go bankrupt and none of that funding materializes. Oh, I mean, there's so many scenarios here that are unpleasant to think about that involve the public just being left holding the bag for the externalities, the damages that have been caused by carbon. And I'm also there's this kind of question of whether these fossil fuel companies will become carbon removal companies because they have the technology, the expertise, the capital. And then to me, then it's a question on, you know, of whose terms do they make that transition? Right. I mean, I might prefer to have them not involved whatsoever, but realistically, it seems like there might be a role there.
Right. And that's one of the things that you are flagging here in making the argument that you do in the article that can be found on Jacobin, the need for carbon removal, which is that these fossil fuel companies are poised to be the ones to financially benefit from industrial efforts to remove carbon. And you're saying that's not reason to abandon the whole project, but it does become complicated because if these companies end up being the primary entities that are removing carbon from the atmosphere, if they go bankrupt, then, I mean, again, looking down the road, but if they do go bankrupt, would that also then take down this project of carbon removal, which you are suggesting, despite all of its potential flaws and perils, is still something that must be done?
Yeah. So I think there's a very realistic scenario where, you know, if they went bankrupt, then who would have the capital and the expertise and so forth to drill all these wells? I mean, I say that, but I want to acknowledge that, you know, the U.S. government has been heavily involved in many of the pilot projects for carbon capture and storage and financing them. So it's not like they've been doing all this technology development themselves. I mean, the public via the Department of Energy has had a pretty big role so far. But that is something I'm concerned about.
Well, tell us more about the technology that is involved in carbon removal, particularly of the industrial type. What does it look like? And is it something that needs to be developed further? Is this really feasible on the kind of scale that is necessary?
Yeah, well, so what you'll hear a lot of people saying is that we need a portfolio of different approaches. And so it's kind of imagined that all of these different techniques will be used. Also, that there'll be a sequence to some of them. For example, some of the land-based carbon removal, like soil carbon storage and afforestation, are things we know how to do right now. So there's an argument that those would be used in the near term, while some of the infrastructure and technology for this geological carbon removal is set out in the long term. And one thing I would note about this portfolio is that it sounds really great, like that, you know, you'll go to these meetings and people will say silver buckshot all the time, like no silver bullet. But the thing about some of these technologies is that they may compete with each other in ways that makes the portfolio language a bit complicated. But I'll talk a little bit more about one in particular that I haven't mentioned yet, which is direct air capture. So that's basically a technology that, if you see some of the visualizations or the pilot projects, looks kind of like giant fans, because there are giant fans that kind of blow air through them. And chemically, the carbon kind of sticks to a sorbent that gets squeezed out and regenerated. That's a very crude way of talking about this process. But you have to picture kind of arrays the size of several shipping containers that take carbon out from the atmosphere, and then the carbon needs to be piped somewhere and stored. And so right now there's some pilot facilities for this you might have read about in the press. There's one in British Columbia. There's one in Switzerland. Right now the carbon isn't being stored geologically. It's being used, for example, in greenhouses to grow cucumbers and tomatoes, or it's being turned into fuels in a process that's called air to fuels, basically making transportation fuels out of carbon captured dioxide, which is another potentially enormous use for this. So those don't necessarily produce negative emissions. Well, they don't produce negative emissions because the carbon gets burned and put back into the system. But ideally, they would be carbon neutral, and then if you store the carbon geologically, carbon negative. if the processes are powered by renewable or low carbon energy. So one of the challenges with this direct air capture technology is its energy footprint. And you can imagine that a lot of land for solar would be required to power this, or nuclear power would be another way to power those carbon removal processes. And so if you picture the infrastructure for that, the carbon removal units aren't necessarily the largest part or the part with the biggest land footprint. It's really the renewable energy that might be powering it that might have a larger footprint. And in either case, if you're thinking about some of these large scale removals, like are in these models for getting to 1.5 degrees or 2 degrees, you have to basically picture something on the order of the existing fossil fuel industry, but for putting the carbon back underground.
So a vast infrastructure, in other words.
Yeah.
So these massive fans, do they have to be in rural areas? Can they be anywhere, or are there some specific requirements in terms of their location?
Well, you want to put them where the carbon can be injected and stored. And so it's really a geological consideration. And so a lot of those lands you might find in the places where oil or coal has already been extracted.
And how feasible is it to transport carbon through pipelines?
Well, it's very feasible. It's something, and we have a few thousand miles of carbon dioxide pipelines already. And the thing with the direct air capture is that you might not need this whole pipeline network if you build these facilities right where the carbon is going to be injected.
And it's okay to be taking the carbon out at the same spot over and over again versus having it spread out over a larger area?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And I don't think there's been very much research done on it, but it would be part of a regulatory apparatus that they would want to look into. Like, for example, if you pulled out a lot of carbon in one spot and then a farmer nearby claims that they're crops aren't growing as well, how are you going to resolve that kind of issue? So I think that there's more scientific work that needs to be done there.
You mentioned earlier soil carbon storage. So what is that and how does it contrast to what you're just describing, direct air capture?
Yeah, so this is a really exciting area. Our listeners might have heard about regenerative agriculture. That's kind of one part of this. Well, carbon farming is one part of regenerative agriculture, I should say. So carbon farming is basically techniques that will increase soil carbon. And that includes things like no-till agriculture, using crop residues and leaving them on the land. And so those practices have the potential, if scaled up in a lot of places, to sequester a few gigatons per year of carbon. And you've seen recently a lot of interest in this. There's even a regenerative organic certification scheme coming out so that consumers who want to purchase products that are grown regeneratively can do so. The downside with soil carbon storage is that after some decades, the amount of carbon that can be stored in the soils will plateau, and the farmers kind of have to hold it there and maintain it there. And so in a way, it's vulnerable to loss. And it's something that after a few decades couldn't be repeated in that same place. So it's a different kind of architecture than something like direct air capture, which in theory could be done indefinitely.
Right. And you make the point that cleaning up carbon may be a very long project. I mean, this is not just a one-off, but this could go on theoretically for centuries.
Yeah.
Which is certainly a sobering thought. With direct air capture, how effective is it? Is it known how effective it would be if some countries opted to do it and other countries didn't? Does it need to be, absolutely global to work?
Yeah, I have a hard time imagining it achieving this kind of scale without an international agreement on it, and probably some international level scheme where carbon removal obligations are laid out in different national commitments, and probably nations decide, you know, how many tons that they're going to remove by X year, and that kind of process, similar to what we've seen at the UN level already.
Sure. I'm speaking with Holly Jean Buck. She is research fellow at UCLA's Institute of the Environment and Sustainability. You're listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly, and we'll return with her in just a moment. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Today, we're talking about the promise and perils of carbon removal and why, as my guest argues, the left needs to be involved in shaping the politics of carbon removal into the future. Her name is Holly Jean Buck. She is a writer, geographer, and sociologist, and she's the author of the forthcoming book out in the fall from Verso, After Geoengineering. So we were talking about the ways that carbon can be removed from the atmosphere, including direct air capture, which you were highlighting as, in some sense, one of the most viable types in that, unlike other forms of carbon storage, it doesn't get saturated over a few decades. How expensive is direct air capture?
That's been a matter of debate. What I would say is that we don't really know yet how expensive it might eventually be. So one of the earlier reports put a figure at about $600 a ton. There's a company in British Columbia that claims a range between kind of $100 to $200 a ton for removal. But some of that is assuming that the product is used for fuels, not for sequestration underground. And then you hear the argument that, you know, most technologies, when they're introduced, they're expensive at first in the demonstration stage, and then when they're scaled up, the cost comes down. So I think if anybody could tell you the answer to that with some level of certainty, they'd be in a great place to make some speculative investments. I think right now it's hard to say how much it costs and how much it will eventually cost.
But would it be fair to say that it's really hard to picture any of this happening without the intervention of the state, and that the state would need to be involved in funding this?
Oh, yeah, I agree completely, because this type of scale is really just a massive waste disposal project. So you'll hear a lot of talk about carbon tech and the carbon to value economy, and about different, you know, uses for carbon, from shoes to makeup, all these products that can be made if we just turn carbon into value. And there's probably is some money to be made there, but the scale of our emissions are so huge that there's a paper out in the scientific world that calculated that you could only productively use 1% of the carbon that's been emitted. If you count enhanced oil recovery, maybe you could use 4 to 8% of the carbon that's emitted and generate some economic value. But that other 99% is basically a cleanup operation. I don't see there's a huge profit to be made once you reach that kind of scale.
And is the state necessary at this point to develop these technologies further? I mean, are they sort of feasible and ready to go, or does a lot more research need to be done at this point?
I think there's varying stages. I think for some of these things, the technology is ready to go. I think, you know, the challenge is getting the cost down so that it's viable to sequester the carbon instead of turn it into fuel or something else to generate back the money. And I also think there's a lot of things that aren't maybe being explored to the degree they could, because there's no obvious economic case, and that's where the state has a huge role. So, for example, the U.S. Department of Energy's Advanced Research Projects Agency, ARPA-E, has a pretty robust several million dollar program on making novel biofuels from macroalgae growing in the ocean. And that's something that there's no real market case for right now, but you know, the government has stepped in to say, hey, we could use some scientific research on this. Let's see what we can do. And I think we need that kind of level of R&D by the government, but at a much, much higher level than we've seen so far.
Well, one complicated part to this, which most of us wouldn't think of when we're thinking about technologies that would be necessary for capturing the carbon from the atmosphere and sequestering it away, is tracking the data, tracking the carbon data, and managing the platforms where that data is tracked. Can you explain that dimension of it to us and the problems that can arise around the question of data?
Yeah, I think we can just look at kind of some of the issues with carbon markets today, and that becomes pretty clear. So there's issues, you know, with double counting, for example, different parties both claiming carbon offsets or carbon removals. Then there's the issue of proprietary methodologies for tracking carbon, and only certain people being in a position to verify what happened to the carbon and so forth. And there's some interesting developments. For example, a startup called Nori is thinking about how to make open source platforms for carbon removal so that methodologies and verifications can be out in the open. But I think that there will probably also be interest by big tech companies for tracking these carbon flows and maybe owning that data. It kind of remains to be seen. It's kind of the Wild West and the carbon frontier right now in terms of the intersection of information technology and carbon.
Well, would there be a role to play of the state in this question? I mean, in terms of tracking what happens to the carbon, how much is produced, how much is stored, et cetera.
One thing I would want to highlight is that a lot of the, when tracking agricultural carbon, for example, a lot of that is done via a model by the USDA that they have developed and supported. So I don't want to minimize the already existing role of the state in this, but I think that on both the biological side and the geological side, especially when it comes to monitoring what happens. So for example, there's a tax credit right now for carbon capture and storage called 45Q. And in order to claim that tax credit, companies have to verify and report to the EPA that their carbon stays underground. But Clean Water Action did a report on this, and they found that 60 million metric tons of CO2 were claimed to the IRS, but only 3 million were reported to the EPA for verification. And so they're really calling for no sequestration without verification. So there's this whole accountability aspect to the tracking the carbon that I think the state has obviously a huge role in.
Well, let's talk about the state. And I should say I'm speaking with Holly Jean Buck. She is the author of an article you can find on our website, againstthegrain.org. On Jacobin, the need for carbon removal in the fall. Her book will come out from Verso after Geoengineering. And I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you detailed earlier the kinds of concerns that people on the left, environmentalists, may have around carbon removal, and many of which you think are very serious and legitimate concerns. And yet you're also arguing that if there's any chance of slowing global warming down, carbon removal will have to be part of the equation. And then the question remains, who will shape the way that carbon removal will take place, and how will it be governed, and who will have a stake in, well, you're suggesting everyone will have a stake, but who will actually have a say in what that all looks like. So I wanted to talk to you about the ways that carbon removal is being legislated right now and the degree to which people who might be, let's just say, progressively minded are shaping any of that.
Yeah, I think that there's different things happening in the U.S. context on both the biological and the geological side. Different states are looking at, for example, soil carbon and how to provide incentives for that. California with their Healthy Soils Program, New York, Maryland, different states are thinking about that. And then on the geologic side, there's discussion about how to incentivize, for example, direct air capture. There's an act called the Use It Act that's been introduced that would offer kind of a prize incentive for some of that R&D. So there's kind of stirrings about it, but there hasn't been a huge push. And this is where I think the conversations around the Green New Deal are really interesting, because there's a lot of points where carbon removal really aligns with a lot of the goals of the Green New Deal in terms of repairing and upgrading infrastructure, upgrading buildings, clean manufacturing, potentially removing emissions from industry with carbon capture and storage, restoring and protecting ecosystems, thinking about the agricultural sector and farming and land use practices that increase soil health. I think there's a lot of points of engagement, and my hope is that people thinking within the Green New Deal or even more radical frameworks will think about where carbon removal fits into the things they're already advocating for.
To what degree are fossil fuel lobbyists shaping the politics around carbon removal?
That's an interesting question. I don't have empirical data on that. I think that you've seen what's actually a bipartisan effort with a lot of tortured compromises when we look at some of these national level legislations like the reformed tax credit and now this Use It Act. You see leadership from both Republican senators thinking about, you know, we need innovation, not regulation, and that kind of a frame. But then you also see senators like Senator Whitehouse from Rhode Island, for example, who's pretty progressive on climate politics on the Democratic side, being willing to engage with these people for a shared goal about research and development on carbon removal. So I do think there's a huge potential for fossil fuel lobbyists to end up shaping this, which is why I hope that we can have some anticipatory engagement before that happens. Because I think a lot of the fossil fuel companies are still not really engaging with this topic yet. And then I think they might in the future. So,
well, what would a more justice-oriented carbon removal look like?
Yeah, I think that one part of it is putting it in conversation with talking about a managed decline of fossil fuels and seeing these as part of the same process. On one hand, ramping down the fossil fuels. On the other hand, starting up a new sector in carbon removal. And so, for example, I'm thinking about things like putting quotas on fossil fuel production and linking those with certificates of carbon removal obligation, which has been discussed a tiny bit in the academic literature, but not really in the political sphere.
Can you tell us more about that? What would look like, what that means?
Yeah, well, any of my ideas for kind of what a more just form of carbon removal would look like, I mean, this really needs to be a collective conversation. But I think that, you know, if companies have certain caps on what they can produce and those are determined and shifted by the government, and then they, for every ton that's produced, there's a certificate of obligation that they have to go to one of these removal service providers and have that carbon verified to be removed. And I don't really see too many other ways forward than something around that. But I'm hoping that, you know, all the politically smart people out there will come out with even better, more nuanced, more challenging, more ambitious, more creative ideas.
You write that however carbon removal plays out, whether the sort of a more just, egalitarian, ecologically minded direction or one that would not be just, driven by the fossil fuel industry, that rural areas are going to be the arena for much of this. So I wonder if you could tell us, and in fact you say, either way it plays out, we should see this as a rural economic development issue. How so?
Yeah, I think that, you know, these are the landscapes where this carbon is going to be removed, and these are the people that will have the jobs or the labor of removing it. And that can be, you know, a positive thing, maybe on the sense of job as being an opportunity. It can also be a huge burden, and a burden that can fall disproportionately on different groups of women or people of color. So, but it might be conceived of in the cities, but it's the rural landscapes where this is going to happen, including landscapes that are, you know, with settler colonialism happening, which is also something that needs to be part of this discussion.
Sure. And then in terms of the workers who would be involved in this industry, do you have any thoughts on how a more just carbon removal would, what it would look like in, say, a U.S. context?
Yeah, I mean, on the biological side, I think there's a lot that can be done to support farmers in this transition. And I think there are a number of farmers who are really interested in a transition to regenerative agriculture, who see the effects of the loss of soil degradation on their lands, but don't necessarily have the capital or resources to make the transition to these other practices. And there's a huge role of the state in supporting that type of transition. And then for people currently employed by the fossil fuel industry, I think there's a huge opportunity to talk about a just transition to carbon removal jobs. At the same time, I'm aware that all of this is happening on the backdrop of a lot of jobs being automated. And so I think that's something that we have to consider. If you think about a direct air capture industry and setting up direct air capture facilities, it's imagined that a lot of those would be kind of automatically run. And so the jobs there might be something of a maintenance technician that comes in now and then to check on the machines, rather than a whole community, you know, being supported by that type of industry. And so that's a very different picture that needs to be considered.
Well, who should be the targets of concerned people who are feeling urgent about the pace of climate change, feel like very little has been done? Should we be targeting these companies that have disproportionately created this problem? Should we be targeting the state? Where should our efforts be going to try to force a just type of carbon removal, and beyond just, carbon removal at all?
Yeah, I think definitely with our elected officials. And I think that, I mean, talking about this in conjunction with all the talk around climate change and climate policy more generally, it's part of it. It's decarbonization and then even more decarbonization to get to negative. So I see it as very much related with all the effort that's going on. And I think that for me, the message is we have to manage the decline of fossil fuels. Talking about innovation and carbon removal is great, but it's the flip side is what's in technical jargon, exnovation, or, you know, managed decline, sunset setting, phasing out of fossil fuels. And how can we do that in a way that supports communities where fossil fuel production is taking place? And I think that we can formulate demands around that. And, you know, it can be our project. It doesn't have to be the project of these fossil fuel companies that we react to after they've put it on the agenda. If we act now and get into this conversation while it's still emergent and shifting and malleable.
Holly Jean Buck, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with the writer, geographer, and sociologist. She's research fellow at UCLA's Institute of the Environment and Sustainability, and she will have a book coming out in the fall from Verso after geoengineering. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.